Hi, I'm Brian McCreath. Welcome to The Answered Question, a podcast from WCRB in Boston for Friday, October 16th, 2015. Each week, we bring you the ideas and insights of great musicians in their own voices. Our interviews usually preview WCRB's live broadcast of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And this music is from the Second Symphony by Brahms in concert last weekend with the BSO and music director Andres Nelsons. It's a concert that's available on demand right now at our website, and you can also hear it this coming Monday, October 19th, on the radio and streaming online at classicalwcrb.org. And that's where you'll find more information about this podcast, or just subscribe through iTunes or whichever podcast app you use to have The Answered Question delivered to your phone or device every Friday. And if you're curious about that title, take a listen to the pilot episode where all is explained. That BSO concert last week featured three pieces: Divisions by Sebastian Currier, the Piano Concerto No. 3 by Beethoven with soloist Lars Vogt, and the Symphony No. 2 by Brahms. Lars Vogt was the guest on last week's podcast, and when I went to the hall to record the interview, I sat in for a little of the rehearsal. Right away, I knew it was going to be a good week when Lars started playing the second movement of the Beethoven. Here's how that moment sounded in concert. Felt like a hymn with this quality of just floating around in midair. Time sort of stopped. And it was a reminder of how those quietest moments in a concert can actually be the most powerful, even when you hear an odd noise here or there in the hall somewhere. Check out the whole concert at classicalwcrb.org. As for this week, nothing so subtle as that Beethoven slow movement. That's the opening of Elektra, the opera by Richard Strauss, and it's the single piece on the program this week. There's no role more demanding in all of the opera repertoire than Elektra, and coming up, you'll hear from the soprano singing that role this week, Christine Gurka. She had a great conversation with my colleague Ron Della Chiesa about Elektra, what it takes to be a singer that can perform that role, and how, in a way, her path was predetermined by what her particular voice was best suited for. But Elektra isn't just a huge challenge for the title role singer. It's a massive virtuoso piece for every singer, every orchestra player, and not least, the person who stands in front of the orchestra to put it all together. That would be Andres Nelsons, the music director of the BSO. I asked him what it was like when he first started to learn the piece and how he managed to make sense of something that goes continuously with no break for an hour and 40 minutes.
You opened the score of Elektra when I opened the first time. I thought, oh my God, I don't know where to start.
Okay.
You know, when you learn the piece, you read the play, you translate the text of Strauss, Elektra, you read the Sophocles, you read. But when you first time open, you have a panic. I had a panic, a bit. But of course, and then when I conducted in Royal Opera House a few years ago, and also Christine Gerke singing. Which was amazing, fantastic, and I took a lot. I think I started 2 years before that to study, and I opened first time. I thought, I'm not going to make it in even 2 years. I have no idea where to start. You know, it's because it's so complex. It's so, and then you calm down and you realize, okay, so now, I need to read the play. I need to translate the text. All right, in this case, in Latvian, I write everything. So I know each word, what it means. Of course, I read the play. I mean, translated in Latvian, or, and after that, of course, I think I try to follow the vocal line, and that dictates in a way the choice of tempo. Of course, you follow the score as Strauss has been writing, but. At some moment, and you look at his scores, the structure of it's sometimes not so clearly presented that you would say, yes, oh, so this is in one tempo, or this is, you know, the four bars in that, and then the four. This is very much to do with a biological clock of a singer, of a breathing, of a heartbeat, and then if you follow the line of the vocal line. Then you realize the big lines and the structure, rather than like in the Brook, for example, Bruckner is so deep, it's more, you can't say mathematical, it's more structural, or, you know, Haydn, you know, it's more, you can see whether it's seven bars or it's eight, or, you know, I think this is I find very, very important. And therefore, at the first moment you open, you sometimes think, oh my God, I don't know what to do, because you have to also become in a certain way, a singer yourself. I find it helps for me to, I think, to realize earlier rather than later that's the line you have to follow, and the heart and the beat and the pulse of that you have to really follow and understand. If you don't understand that, you always get in trouble with singers, or you always get trouble with tempos, because if you look at the Strauss music purely symphonically, not respecting or realizing the vocal challenges, you know, you might take things too fast or too slow, because it's so easy to go too fast or too slow in Strauss, or of course any, but in Strauss particularly too slow, and you know you kill the singer. It's not possible, and you want to take the phrase you know, you can kill Elektra so easily by taking it too slow.
That's Andris Nelsons, the music director of the BSO, who not only did some training as a singer in Latvia, he's also married to one of the top opera singers in the world, Kristina Opelais. So when he talks about deciphering Elektra based on what a singer would do, he knows what he's doing. As for the one who's actually doing most of the singing this week, that would be Christine Gurka. Earlier this week, she talked with Ron Della Chiesa at Symphony Hall. Here's Ron.
Someone said, I doubt there is any opera so violent, so assaulting, and yet so enthralling. Elektra is not an opera one hurries to rehear. It's best approached with some time between performances in order that one's nerves heal, yet each occasion one hears it may well increase one's regard for the striking genius of its creation. And we have Elektra with us. Thanks so much.
Pleasure for being here.
Talking about this role. And by the way, I want to mention that there's a nice connection with the Boston Symphony, because your first role was not Elektra, but Chrysothemis.
That's right.
With Seiji Ozawa, a former music director. How did that happen?
It was his idea. And it was interesting because I was starting to head into sort of the baby big girl rep. And this was my first baby big girl role, Chrysothemis. And it was a great opportunity for me to work on it, as I had worked with Seiji so many times, and he knew me so well, and I knew him as well, because we'd worked together so often. We had a very long rehearsal period, and it was amazing to get with an orchestra this size for the first time. I was worried because I thought perhaps it was too soon to be stepping into big roles, and there's always that fear if it's not right. You could be doing damage, it might be too soon, and, you know, so many singers have fallen into that trap. But the second we got with the orchestra, I realized it was not too soon, and it was right, and I felt at home for the first time in years.
Few are chosen to sing this role. I mean, you follow a long tradition of Birgit Nielsen, Astrid Varnai.
So no pressure.
you've got the good. You were blessed. You've got the goods to do it, but it didn't start that way, did it, with your voice?
Well, no. The thing is when nobody starts out singing this repertoire, you know. And I was very lucky because when I was younger, I still have, but it's a little slower. Very quick coloratura, and I sang a lot of coloratura roles, and I ended up singing dramatic coloratura roles. So a lot of Handel, a lot of Mozart, and I cut my teeth there, and I was very happy living there for a decade, and. People were telling me from the time that I was 25 years old that I was a dramatic soprano. And not really anybody's a dramatic soprano at 25, but they heard where it was going. I read up on that kind of voice, thinking, well, if they're right, I should know something about this. And I knew that there would be a big bump in the road at some point. And usually that happens around 40, and you sort of stop, retool, and go into new repertoire. But it started much earlier for me. In my early 30s, I remember when this happened, I was doing a run of Alcina at New York City Opera, rest in peace, and I was doing what I always did, and Handel fit me like a glove, but suddenly things just felt wrong. And I worked very hard. I was practicing constantly. I was doing everything that I normally did, but nothing seemed to be working right. And I was so frustrated, and I know everybody else was frustrated as well, and I just thought, I've got to make a change. So I switched voice teachers, tried a new technique, realized that I had somehow disconnected from my support because my voice was growing. And so to try to keep it in a smaller place in order to sing the more lyric repertoire, I had cut off from my support. And the minute I reconnected to that, all of a sudden, three times the sound came out and I realized, okay, it's time to start changing repertoire.
Wow, so you had a whole new technique?
Yes and no. It was more about reconnecting to my body. And as singers, we have to learn support. It's the same thing with wind players. Everything is about connecting to your support and your breath. And I had come off of my support in order to try to sing lighter. And I didn't realize I had done it, but just that's how I somehow rationalized I should go forward if I was going to stay in the repertoire I was in. And that was wrong. So when I went to my new teacher, I studied with Diana Soviero, and I have since then. She said to me, she was, I don't know why you came off of your support, but this has to stop. And I immediately reconnected. And every week she would come in, she goes, oh, God, there's more in there.
So now you said in an interview with Opera News, now you can use the D word. You're not afraid of dramatic soprano,
yeah, no,
right?
Now I'm definitely using the D word.
Absolutely. With Elektra, are you kidding? Okay, here you are singing Elektra. Strauss once said, the orchestra, play louder, I can still hear the singers. I mean, you know that line.
I do.
But it's physical. I mean, it's like running a marathon, isn't it?
It is.
You got to avoid hitting the wall with this.
That's absolutely true. And when I talk about these dramatic roles, this one is a very easy one to explain it with. It's an hour and change, hour and 40 or so, depending on who's conducting. And the only way to survive this is to go through and make a map for yourself. Find the big moments, find out what's in between, find the places to rest. And I literally draw myself a little graph. And I know I have to deliver here, I have to deliver here, I have to deliver here. All the brass are playing, everyone and their mother, maybe a couple of people in the audience are also playing at this point. So the cacophony is astonishing. It is awesome, but it is big. And when that's the case, then I really need to use all of the reserves. After that, there's generally going to be a couple of places where I can lay back and there's another character that's taking the reins. A good way to just explain it in the opening, the monologue is a huge, huge sing. But after the monologue is over, then it's all about Chrysotomus for a while. Mm-hmm. And I don't have much to do during that. And then after that, it's mostly about Clytemnestra. Then I have to deliver again. So I pace myself that way, and I lay back when I can, and I bring it full on when I need to.
And the role is there. I mean, when you perform this role with different orchestras, mm-hmm. different productions, it's all up there. Does it just roll out like it's always there?
You know, the thing is, I was a bit terrified. I hadn't done it in a year. And a week ago, I came off of a run of Turandot at the Metropolitan Opera, and that's something slightly different. So the minute I got done, I gave myself 2 days off from singing, because loud things. And then I decided, right, I better start looking at this. Generally, with roles like this, once you've done them so many times, they're in your head. But everyone has their little quirk about how their nerves work. my nervous thing is that no matter how many times I have sung a role, no matter if I've sung it the day before, the entire thing all the way through without mistakes, I will be standing waiting to go on stage and I won't remember anything past the first word. And I'll just think, God, I hope it's in there. And I'll step out on stage, hope for the best.
And no two performances are ever the same. Of course, you get different colleagues.
Of course.
Different orchestras, different productions.
But why would you want two performances to be the same? That's the cool thing about live performance.
Right. Exactly. Let's talk about Andras Nelsons, too, this young conductor that we're so excited about in Boston. We're so lucky to have him. And the fact that a lot of young people are coming into the hall now to hear this guy. He's only 36 years old.
It's amazing. It's amazing. He's only 36, but he has a childish exuberance. And I mean that as the greatest compliment in the entire world. So it's like seeing, you know, a 10-year-old getting excited about something that they love more than anything. But he has the soul of somebody who's 80. I mean, it's incredible to see the juxtaposition of the two and the product of these two things coming together. He loves music. He just loves music. And he's positively gleeful about it. I love to watch him. I don't say that all the time. A lot of singers don't watch the conductor. I'm so sorry. Sometimes we're actually thinking about acting and everything. But to be honest, even when I'm not singing, I cannot help but get sucked into watching him because he's exciting and he's excited. And that translates to the people in front of him, which then translates to the audience.
And so many of the orchestra members feel the same way.
Ugh.
Because we look at him up here in the booth, I can look the head on camera where I can see him. Normally people in the hall, you know, as the conductor said, pardon my back. But if you're on the side and you watch his expressions,
he giggles.
He's redrawing it out of the orchestra.
He giggles. When he gets excited, he giggles. I giggle too. It's not good to giggle during Elektra. I'm going to try not to giggle. But it's amazing to see the joy coming off of him. It's absolutely true what you said.
Well, after all, it's hard to giggle when you're an axe murderer, right? I
mean, well, you never know. Axe murderers are kind of crazy. They might giggle. I've never met one. I didn't do that much research.
you've had this amazing career as a youngster growing up in Long Island,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And in high school, you played clarinet.
I did.
And you wanted to be a teacher.
I did.
Tell us about what happened with your father, because he was a big fan of Artie Shaw.
He was.
The big band era.
So the funny thing was, is fourth grade was when they started offering band instruments. They offered string instruments in third grade, and get ready to insert joke here, I was the only kid in school that wanted to play the viola, so you can see where this went. Well, I still love viola. It's still my favorite. And it was interesting because he didn't think I would stick with it, my dad. I had a tendency to start things and not finish them. So I would go every week, and they taught me how to shake my hand and then hold it. And that's how you held the instrument. And 3 weeks I showed up and shook my hand. And they finally said, if you're not going to get an instrument, you have to leave. So I did. And the following year I went back, and they were offering the band instruments. So I'm very excited about this. Came running home and I said, Dad, they're offering band instruments. I really want to play the flute. And he goes, I got you a clarinet. I was like, why?
Did he play clarinet?
He didn't, but he loved Artie Shaw.
He did.
So that's why he got, I thought, oh, it's close.
That's
not
such
really,
a great connection with the, you know, your the clarinet and Artie Shaw and your dad.
Right. But now a lot of the music I play, you know, and I ended up being a bass clarinet player, which I completely adored. And it's funny because a lot of the things that I sing now in this dramatic repertoire, somehow or another, my parts are very often paired with the clarinets and the bass clarinets.
Really?
So I kind of get all giggly when that happens.
So you put aside the clarinet.
Yeah.
And then?
I went to start studying music education at SUNY Fredonia in New York. And as part of the initial entrance exams, they gave all of the instrumental majors a sight singing test just for placement into the classes. And they heard me and they said, why don't you audition for the upper division choirs? And I said, because I'm a clarinet player, I don't sing. And all of my friends that I had met from Long Island were all vocal majors. And they said, well, we have to go audition. Why don't you come with us? I said, fine. Because I wanted to be liked. How sad. And I went. And I auditioned. And none of them got in. And I did. And I thought, okay, well, I'll just be a choral teacher. Because I can magically teach myself piano. My brain doesn't work very well.
Amazing.
And I started to study voice. And I started studying. And I realized that I loved choral music. I worked with Robert Shaw a lot. But it became really clear very early on that a soloist kind of path was going to be more what my voice was suited to. And I just started studying voice and ended up in the Met Young Artist program for 3 years. I was very lucky with that. And now we're here singing Electra.
You're very upbeat. And I think that I think that your colleagues picked that up on you. I watched you at the rehearsal. You were kidding around. You were having a good time up there.
I have a good job.
And, you know, I mean, people talk about divas. You're the most undiva-like person I think
I
met in this world.
I know, I gotta work on
that. And now you're out there singing Brunhildes, right?
Yeah.
And all these other, you got rings coming up.
I do. But Brunhilde's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, especially when you start right at the beginning, she's like super cool teen that rides a flying horse. I mean, how do you get better than that? I mean, she's amazing.
Yeah. I want to talk about your relationship. How you met your husband, because it's a great story.
Uh-huh.
He's a construction worker.
Yeah.
He'd never heard of an opera.
Nope.
And all of a sudden, you know, you find each other.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes to the opera with
you. He did. You know, the funny thing was, is we first started dating, and he also told me later on, I caught him telling the story at a party, saying that she said she was an opera singer. I didn't believe her. And I overheard him, and I said, who lies about that? You can call somebody on that. If I was going to lie, I'd say like a marine biologist or an astronaut or something really cool. But he wanted to come to an opera. He had been to one concert with me, and he asked what my next opera was. And I said, you don't want to come to this as a first one. It's Norma. That's not it. But I'm singing Bohème. Yes, I sang Bohème. And I sang Musetta. Figure that out. But I said, come to Bohème. That's a great first opera. And he said, no, I want to come to this Norma. And I thought, okay, I'm going to lose him, but fine. He came, and I finished the performance, and he came backstage, and he had tears rolling down his face. And I thought, oh, what is this? And he just walked up to me, and he said, I had no idea. I just had no idea. And there's nothing better than winning over a civilian.
Isn't
that
true?
The first time, if you hook them, it's the best feeling ever. Then we're doing our job.
You're right. And I was lucky because my wife and I, we love opera.
Uh-huh.
It was a relationship right from the beginning.
Oh,
we've been
cool.
Married, you know, almost 30 years.
Oh, God bless.
And I said, you know, you really know you're in love with somebody when you can hold hands at the opera and cry and weep.
It's perfect.
Yeah. Then you know.
That's right.
You really know.
Uh-huh.
Okay. There's a famous story about Richard Strauss. He get into a cab somewhere somewhere in Germany, going to a conducting gig. And they said, oh, Maestro Strauss, I'm so honored to have you in this cab. Where can I take you? And he said, anywhere, I'm in demand all over. Now, you don't have an ego, but you are in demand all over. Christine Gerke is in demand all over. You must be planning your seasons 2, 3, 4, 5 years ahead because everybody wants you.
Yeah, I mean, it's very funny when you've had the bump in the road that I have, when magically all of a sudden there's not much in your schedule at all, which is terrifying, and then you go to having work years out. It's kind of funny, in fact, because somebody asked me to do something just now in 2021, and
wow.
I was thrilled. And of course I said yes, because I have 2 kids to put through college, so thank God for that. But I went home and I told my husband, I said, I might be working at Dunkin' Donuts in 21. I don't know what's going to happen by then. I hope not. But, you know, I mean, that's a long time from now. And I feel so unbelievably lucky just to be able to do this job and connect with people who are in front of me. It sounds very silly and sort of cliche, but it's sharing energy for a couple of hours.
Right.
And if I'm exhausted at the end and they're exhausted at the end, then everything went right.
I'll never forget. Years ago, when I interviewed the great Eileen Farrell.
Oh, my goodness.
She called her the queen of crossover when nobody knew crossover. Eileen was doing jazz.
No kidding.
So when she was with the Met at Rudolph Bing in the early 60s, I asked her in an interview. I said, well, what did you want to sing? She said, well, they wanted me to sing this stuff, Alceste, Gluck. I wanted to sing Wagner, you know, and she ended up just singing. She never got a chance to really show her stuff with Wagner, except she made a great recording with Munch and the Immolation scene.
Mm-hmm.
But as I've often said, few are chosen to do it. And you're planning your seasons ahead. You have to think about, of course, your family.
Right.
You're going to be on the road a lot, rehearsing. And you never know what kind of production they're going to put you in either, right?
That's true. But, you know, the funny thing is, I never go into a rehearsal. If it's a new production, if I don't know the production, I never go into a rehearsal without having thought through the entire role in my head already and made all of the decisions for myself in my head. And I know on day one, I am willing to change every single one of them. But I come with my own idea of what the path for the character is.
Yeah.
And then that's something that you listen to the director and you find out what they want from you. And then you find out how much of what you think and what they think can come together. And that's how you make a final product. And so it doesn't matter really what kind of the production it is. You know, we're doing something that's in concert here. And if you're using the text and you trust the music, it doesn't really matter what's behind you.
You came up with a pretty exciting new era of singers. Nathan Gunn.
Yeah.
Stephanie Blythe, mm-hmm. Michelle DeYoung,
mm-hmm. Sandra Radwanowski.
Sandra Radwanowski, mm-hmm. you talk about that. I mean, that's sort of the group of the new group of singers who are really making a mark.
Yep.
In the opera world these
Absolutely.
Days.
Absolutely.
Great names that are coming up, and you know, people tend to think about the other era, but this is a great era we're in now.
Do you know the thing is I feel like we will always look back to the years before, and there'll always be the golden age of opera, which will be whatever the golden age is for the people who have listened. And it's, you know, we can never take away from the people who have come before. I have my idols just like everyone else. But I just encourage people to listen with new ears every single time that mm-hmm. they go, because when I hear that, oh, we don't have any so-and-sos anymore. Well, that's true. They're dead. But they were amazing. And there's so many of us that are so desperate to give you everything that we have too.
Right.
And then after us, there will be another generation doing exactly the same thing, because it's not dying.
But of course, your generation came up. Brigitte Nielsen didn't grow up listening to Bruce Springsteen. You know, so
well, that's a different. Fair, but she would have liked it, I think.
She would have. It's a different. It's a different generation that you came up with. You know, the era you were a part of.
That's true. That's true. And I didn't listen to opera. My very first opera that I listened to, I happened upon it completely by accident. I had a teeny tiny little black and white television in my bedroom, and I was about 13 years old, and I was flipping through the channels, and I came across a PBS thing that was on, and my father came up and he was watching. He said, "What are you listening to? What is this?" And I said, "I don't know. I think it's an opera." It was Francesca da Rimini, the broadcast from the Met of all weird first things to listen to. I fell in love with it. I thought, who knew this sounded like that? That's pretty cool. Didn't think I was going to do it, but it only took me getting a few minutes of it to be completely psyched by it. And I really wanted to go see some more of it.
All right, let's talk about that. Are there things that intrigue you in the Italian repertoire that you like?
Oh, absolutely.
To do?
Well, you know, here's the thing. There's a handful of stuff that I would like to do in the Italian repertoire. My voice as a dramatic soprano, I like to sit in the middle, go up and sing high notes and come back down. For the most part, I don't like to hang out at the top of the staff for 4 hours. So God bless all you Verdi sopranos, but not for me. But if anybody needs an Eboli, I'm your girl. But the thing is, there are some roles that I'm dying to do. I kind of have my eye on Minnie. I would love to do that. I've just started doing Turandot again, so I'm enjoying that. I would love to sing Santuzza. So hopefully there'll be a Cavalleria in my future.
Great role.
Yeah. There are some Italian roles.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your family.
Yeah.
And two children.
Two girls, yep.
Two girls. Mm-hmm. How old are they?
They are 6 and 8, and they're going on 18 and 43, I think.
How do they react to a mother who sings Elektra and Brunhilde? And
they don't care. And I love that. That's exactly what I want. They just know when I'm home, they just want to know where their socks are. Can they play Wii? And can I get, you know, can we go outside? What's for dinner? That's exactly what I want. You know, I offer them every opportunity to come to things when they want to. I don't make them. I make sure they're exposed to music, because I think that that's something that's terrifying to me, that we are losing music in our schools and we're losing arts education in our schools. When people talk about attendance being down at classical events, I am positive that is the problem. We have stopped telling children it's important.
You're going to be singing in the Ring again at the Metropolitan Opera.
I am.
The famous Lepage Ring.
Yeah.
Are you looking forward to that?
I am, actually. I have to say, I grew up with the Schenk, and I got to do a Norn in that one, and I had my heart set on doing that Ring, but I will also say that I think the Lepage Ring is really cool, and I'm very excited to be a part of that. So,
yeah, well, my wife and I were there opening night for mm-hmm. Rheingold when mm-hmm. it first opened, and the stage didn't quite work at the end,
right.
And the headline of the New York Times was "God Stranded Outside Valhalla." But then we, you know, we saw it on HD. And, you know,
it works.
It works. And
when
I
works,
tell people,
works.
I tell people, like, we talk about how get people in opera. Go see an HD opera. It doesn't matter what you see. is so well done.
Absolutely.
The cameras take you right on stage, right into the production.
Absolutely. It's a great way in. But once you've seen one, then go see something live. It's something totally different.
It is.
And it is remarkable. It's amazing to sit in an HD broadcast because you do get a perspective that you wouldn't necessarily get in the theater. But by the same token, when you're sitting in a theater and you're listening to unamplified sound, that just makes your entire body vibrate. And that's amazing. So go see both.
So let's see now. You've got Elektra coming up and you're going to take it to Carnegie Hall with Andras
yes.
Nelsons and this or our orchestra,
it's
we
amazing.
Call it. And then after that, you'll be back at the Met?
Yes. At some
more
point.
Turandot?
No, I'm done with Turandot for the time being. And
but that's HD. We're going to see that in HD.
Yes, but you're going to be seeing Nina Stemma, who's amazing.
Oh, Nina Stemma, okay.
I'm going to be up in Toronto singing Siegfried for Canadian Opera Company at that point.
Wow. I'll never forget when I met my good friend, the great artist Ben Heppner, and he said to me, yeah, he said, she's the real thing. He was talking about you.
Oh, my gosh.
He had seen you in the, I think, up there in production
oh,
in Canada.
Probably the Valkyra that
the
I
Valkyra,
did last year, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I tell you what, I will never forget what an amazing, supportive colleague he was. When he did Lohengrin at the Met, it was then a new production with Robert Wilson, I was assigned to cover Debbie Voigt. And so it was my very first experience with Wagner and I'd sung in Norn, but this was like the first role I'd studied. And I was all excited to just sit back in the back of the room. It was Deborah Pulaski singing and Eric Halverson was singing and Ben and Debbie. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this is going to be amazing. I walked in the first day of rehearsal. I sat way in the back and sitting there with my score being all giggly. And they came up and they said, they told you Debbie's not coming for 2 weeks, right? And I went, I may have thrown up in the bathroom 8 times. I don't know. But Ben was the most lovely, supportive, sweet man ever. And basically just held my hand right through it.
Mm-hmm.
He is.
I remember when he first came to Boston, it was 20 years ago, and he came over the station. And he came over and he made this album of these beautiful old songs, you know, Be My Love.
Right.
And all these old Paula songs.
Mm-hmm.
And the phone kept ringing and ringing. And then we went to see him in Parsifal and all these major roles, you know, longer. But speaking of Debbie, she has a new book out, by the way, called Call Me Debbie.
Debbie.
And
oh,
what
yeah.
a read that is.
I have not been able to read it. I'm so lucky if I even like manage to read my scores at this point when
right.
I get home between the kids and everything. But it's on my list.
Yeah, you won't put it down. It's a page turner, believe me.
I believe it.
And I admire her for telling it like it is. Boy, she did not pull any punches.
I'll tell you what, that lady is remarkable. One of the most talented, lovely colleagues and a real person. Never sort of made anybody feel less than.
I want to mention, too, that you sang last summer at Tanglewood, the Mahler Symphony of a Thousand.
Yeah.
That's when we first heard you. Was that your first time at Tanglewood?
I've been there quite a few times in my previous life as a lyric soprano.
Mm-hmm.
I did a couple of concerts with Seiji. I did War Requiem. I did Beethoven Choral Fantasy. Did a concert. He did Falstaff scene.
Mm-hmm.
So we did a big concert with that on there as well. I'd been there a few times, but I hadn't been there in quite some time, and this was amazing to be part of that extravaganza, for lack of a better word.
Well, we're very lucky to have you here doing
this
role.
Oh, it's such a pleasure for me.
You are just an extraordinary career you've had and what you've been through. Wait, let me ask you one other thing.
Yeah.
People, you know, talk about, and Debbie does a bit in the book about some singers she doesn't mention who have egos with colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
You obviously have
yeah,
none
no.
of them, I can tell. You've got such a great sense of humor and easy to work with. But have you ever run up against that?
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you deal with that, with your personality?
You kill them with kindness. The thing is, generally, when somebody has an ego or they have a lot of attitude, there's something behind that. And I'll be perfectly honest with you, what we do is not easy. We have people criticizing it every single time we open our mouths.
Yeah.
Some people deal with that better than others. And there's all kinds of defense mechanisms. And to be perfectly honest, I can generally see past what those are. So when people are having a rough time and they're having a bad day, you know, you make a decision. Either you try to see if you can get past whatever's going on with them, or you know, vaya con Dios and send them with God. And then you just ignore them and you do your thing.
And you said it all. I mean, I've heard this from other singers. This is one tough business.
It is.
Not for the faint of heart. You know, you've got to really have it together to get the way you are. And then beyond that, you're always competing.
Well, yeah. But you know, the funny thing is, especially in this repertoire now that I've gotten here, I find that everyone who sings the repertoire that I sing, everyone knows it is unbelievably difficult. And if we all survive to the end of the night without bleeding, we are all excited. So we hold each other's hands. And we can see when somebody is struggling on stage. And I can't tell the amount of times that I've gone up to somebody and just grabbed their hand and just put my hand on their back to let them know that I was there. And people have done that for me as well.
That's great. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
That's Christine Gurka talking with Ron Della Chiesa at Symphony Hall earlier this week. And you'll hear her sing Electra on our live Boston Symphony broadcast on Saturday, October 17th. We'll also have it for you on demand next week and on the air again on Monday, October 26th. All the info is at classicalwcrb.org. And remember to subscribe to The Answered Question at iTunes. I'm Brian McCreath. Thanks for listening.